Like to call the June 27th, 2023 at 10 a.m. post-council meeting to order. Be held at the Public Safety Education and Training Center at 410 West, 9800 South, third floor of the post-council chambers. I'd first like to start by excusing Mayor Walker, Troy Walker, and Travis Knorr is the proxy for Brian Redd today. With that, I'll go ahead and ask for approval of the March 16th, 2023 minutes. Do I have a motion to approve?
Second.
I have a motion from Spence Austin and a second from Lorena Stevens. Any further discussion? Hearing none, I'll call for the vote. Those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion passes. That we'll go ahead and move forward to Lieutenant Jacqueline Moore and Kristen Newland.
For the quarter of March 1st to May 31st, 2023, investigations received 80 complaints. We opened 32 cases. We did not have any administrative law judge hearings. We closed 7 cases with no action. We received 3 voluntary relinquishments. One was for fraud and falsification of a government record. The second was for BCI violations, and the third was sexual assault. We reviewed 317 basic training applications, 30 dispatcher applications, and 25 waiver reactivation applications. We typically have 60 cases open, or active, sorry. Right now we have 102. We typically have 80 cases open, and right now we have 116. We do have 2 new investigators in backgrounds. Hopefully they will start August and September. Any questions for me? Thank you.
Good morning. Basic training for the past quarter. We had 5 sessions active during the quarter. We completed 3 of them. We have 2 still in session. We had 166 enrolled at the Basic Academy here at Sandy. We graduated 126 with 28 still enrolled in sessions that haven't ended yet. We have an average over the quarter of about 5.37% attrition. But it's important to keep in mind that most of that attrition is people that just didn't graduate on time but will still certify. So the attrition numbers will actually be lower than that. We have 85 enrolled in upcoming sessions for the rest of the calendar year. We're likely able to accommodate about 60 more without splitting or adding classes, and 3 full blocks remaining for the calendar year 23. And in service, we had 37 classes for a total of 462 hours of training offered. We had 882 officers enrolled with 700 completed, and most of those were absentees if they just didn't show up for training. And we also certified 26 dispatchers. Any questions on basic training? Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead and move to the 2023-2024 quarter one curriculum update by John Jacobs.
Yeah. Sir, in a minute.
Oh, so okay. Yeah, we'll go ahead and move forward to Deputy Director Alex Garcia on qualifying canine. What's that?
John. Oh,
all right, John. We'll go ahead and jump back to John.
John was meeting with one of our new employees that's getting ready to start.
All right. John's going to talk about special functions officer and law enforcement officer.
Apologize, counsel. We got a meeting ran over. So, yeah, we were very excited. We're able to fill our position with a curriculum developer researcher. So I was meeting with her and kind of going over, you know, the plan we have here with the curriculum of identifying a gap or a need with law enforcement and quickly being responsive through agency input and subject matter expert and the ability for us to move the curriculum rapidly and be as responsive as we can to the current needs of law enforcement. And so we're excited to get her on board. She's going through the background process and also at the same time, because the legislature authorized our e-learning curriculum developer, that position opened and we filled that with Chris Fielding. That'll not be your DJ anymore. he will become e-learning developer. And so by having a full-time e-learning developer on board, we'll be able to create content a lot faster. And our purpose with creating the content is to have a blended learning approach in the academy. But also because we're developing those pieces for the academy, those are also pieces that can go directly out to agencies via our ACADIS portal. So agencies that are looking to fill a need with a lot of these legislative mandates or things they need to see in their community with their officers being trained, will be dual purposing all of our e-learning. So to give you a curriculum update, the council approved our changes last time, so we've been implementing those changes. They've been focused around legislative mandates, but also gaps that have been identified in the academy. So we have developed all the curriculum, and we actually started, we had a class that started yesterday, and so we've implemented those changes. So some key things that we worked on this last quarter for an update for you is sexual assault victim assistance. We've incorporated more of that into our LEO and our SFO course. Child abuse and neglect has been enhanced with children exposed to violence. We've increased the hours with active shooter, building clearing. Those have already been implemented. Our domestic violence package has been essentially integrated into the curriculum. And then also the hate crimes or targeting curriculum has been put in. So instead of just making it a singular class, we found where in serving diverse communities, we talk about it. An attorney will talk about the enhancements, and then we'll have an investigator talk about evidence collection. And so whenever we have these additional topics, we actually blend it across the academy. So it's just not a one thing. And then also we've moved, based on how council approved, we've moved juvenile law into the law enforcement block. And that is going to help the academies, especially special function officers. There's such a cognitive load of law in the SFO. And so we're trying to help the cadets and improve our rates. So we're not asking for any changes today on our curriculum. We're just giving you an update that based on your recommendation from last post council, we've been able to implement all those changes, which equates to about 28 hours of the academy has been revamped, rebuilt, or rewritten, basic interview and interrogation. All those have been implemented. And so we'll be moving forward. We'll come to you next council with recommendations based on the feedback and input we get from the agencies. So if you have any questions, I apologize once again.
No problem. Any questions for John?
Yes. Yeah.
Thank you. All of that, I know that's a lot of work. My question, I think, is dual for Christian, yes, and yourself, John. Christian, you cited the data of 166, right, starting the program, and 126 that did not graduate from the program at the timely fashion, I guess. My question there is, are the non-graduates related to curriculum and the lack of understanding of curriculum, or is the non-grad related to personal reasons that they didn't make it?
So let me clarify. We got 28 still enrolled in sessions. The attrition rate is very, very low, actually.
Okay.
We average about 5%. Right. Most of those are DTPT. And they are remediated, and most of them do get certified after the fact.
Okay.
But if we do have dismissals, a lot of the time it is the cadet's choice. In fact, this last quarter, I think every one of the dismissals was either the cadet's choice or the agency's decision to remove them.
Okay.
But I'll let John address that.
Yeah, it really comes down to, and when those numbers were from our here, when I look at the numbers, I look at statewide. So we're looking at all the academies statewide. And it really is personal decision is the highest, and then defensive tactics, and those are usually people that eventually will through multiple attempts, but academic is right up there. We don't have that high of attrition rate, but it is academic. And so when we look at academic, we say, are we asking too much? Because we're understanding that this is a basic peace officer that is going to be taken to an agency and trained. It's the 10-80-20 model, where we're going to give them the 10% start. They're going to get that 80% in their agency through field training, through additional training and experience, and then 20% is going to be through lifelong learning. So we're always constantly evaluating our, like with legal, are we asking too complex of a legal question? Or is there just too much legal, like with juvenile law? Juvenile law is a really difficult topic. It's even more difficult when, at the same time, this is the first time you've heard about laws of evidence and constitutional rights and hearsay and all the violations of law, and then to throw on top the complexities of a juvenile system. So this is where we're trying to figure out where we can separate them. But we do look at attrition quite closely, and we're always trying to figure out what we can do in the academy. And personal reasons is kind of hard to overcome. But this last year we did fully develop and implement our officer wellness and resiliency. And there's a lot of conversations we have in that class about personal health and personal mental health and understanding the job and being prepared to not become burnout in the job and to actually have skills and abilities through mindfulness to stay on the job. And so we also see an attrition rate after the academy. From our cadets here, we have a 20% will leave the profession within 2 years. The satellite academies around the state, they're 25%. So we're looking at 20% of everybody we train every year eventually leaves the profession in 2 years. So we're trying to do some analysis on that to find out what as a community or what as post council or what as post can we do to lower that. We've got certified officers. These are certified officers that are actually employed, and within 2 years, 20% have left. And a lot of that comes down to wellness and resiliency and giving them the skills to stay on the job.
Yeah. Any further questions? With that, we're going to go ahead and jump to Curriculum Committee, Alex Garcia, and then he'll follow up with the canine certifying entity discussion.
Good morning. Jumping ahead and kind of just piggybacking off of John, I know there's been some discussion in the past about more involvement from the council as it pertains to curriculum. And as an approach to that and to give the council or at least a smaller subcommittee more time to review our suggested changes or additions to the curriculum, it would be my suggestion to form a subcommittee that when we make changes or we implement something that we can forward that curriculum information to the subcommittee. Subcommittee can review it, make suggestions, and then we can turn over a final product to the entire council on council meeting. I feel that it will better suit the curriculum as far as giving it more eyes on it, as well as giving the council more input, rather than just being handed the changes on the day of and saying, do you accept these changes or not? My only concern or suggestion would be the simple fact that this is going to be time consuming. It's going to take some of your time, and we are going to be dependent upon your strict approval and suggestions, and you're going through it with a fine tooth comb, because this will be the final product, right, that is going out to teach your new officers. So that is my proposal as far as the committee goes. My preference, and once again, this is just my preference. This is your decision as a council. But I strongly encourage an individual, at least one individual from the education system, to be a part of this, because this obviously has a lot to do with adult learning and adult education, and having some expertise on that subcommittee would be helpful.
How many members of the council are you thinking?
As we all know, committees, as they get bigger and bigger, they become less productive. So my suggestion would be 3, maybe 4, maximum. But once again, you as the council are the deciding body.
Additional time, you said it would be time consuming. Will that ebb and flow? Do you anticipate that being kind of a weekly workload addition, or how do you anticipate that?
I'll let John expand on that a little bit, but each quarter is obviously going to be a little bit different, right, depending on what area of the curriculum we're hitting. Conflict management has already been gone through, but if we were to go through conflict management, you look at that, that's 12 hours of review, right? So when that would be completed, that one would be pretty time consuming to go through the entire thing. For instance, when Marcus created the facilitator's guide for that class, it ended up being close to 100 pages, just the facilitator's guide to be able to deliver the material. So that's not including the learning objectives and all of that that John puts together as far as that goes. But our plan is, and correct me if I'm wrong, John, is to, it's not going to be just a information dump on you guys. As we complete couple hours here, depending on how long the class is, right, turn that information over to you guys, allow you to review it in chunks instead of just saying, hey, here's 10 hours of work for you, right?
So with that, if we're going to come up with those names, we'd probably ask for a motion to establish the committee. So we probably need to figure out who we want on that. And if it's three or four, I would ask this body to give me a recommendation of who you would see like to see on that.
So you need a motion to
make
the committee.
To make the committee.
I'll make a motion. We accept the nominate people for that committee.
Second.
A second motion. John Crowley and Miley Lou. Do we have a second?
There's
a second.
Miley.
Okay. Those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, that motion passes. And then I guess what we need to do is come up with a recommendation as to who should serve on that committee.
Chairman, I'd like to suggest that Miley Lou sit on that committee. She's more than adequately qualified.
We've got a motion to accept Miley Lou.
Second.
We've got a second from Chief Swanson. Are you willing to do that, Miley? That's great. Okay, we have one. What other recommendations do we have?
Can I just say, maybe if we, as a committee, met, if we could meet like after 2 or after 3, so it doesn't interfere with my duties at part-time duties at the U when school is in session. I'm usually busy from 8 to 2.
So if that would weigh in on any of your.
If I could, a lot of it's going to be email communication.
Okay.
Sending documents. Peer review, everybody collaborating on a document as it's being sent out. So it won't be a lot of in-person meetings. If that helps kind of understand the schedule.
It'll mostly come to you like in Google Doc format, right, where changes are tracked and you can see other individuals' comments, any other members in the committee, any comments that John or myself or any of the other curriculum team respond to. It'll be all on the singular document for the most part.
I'm happy to participate under those circumstances. I'm happy to help.
So, Melina, do we have a motion to approve Melina?
So moved.
And second? Second from Sheriff Wimmer. So we have one or two other positions.
I think it'd be great to have someone that's in law enforcement participating as well.
That was going to be my suggestion. I know I didn't want to put any pressure on anybody. Or put anybody on the spot, but I think that perspective is much needed as well as from the education side.
So that could be DPS, chiefs, or sheriffs, or corrections. Colonel Rappish, we have a motion to accept. Colonel Rappish,
second.
From Kelly Sparks, and a second from Spence Austin. And we have one more.
We wanted 4, but what did you get to get a chief and a sheriff?
Could ask for a chief and a sheriff that's willing to serve on that.
I'd be happy to do it.
Sheriff Sparks.
A motion to accept.
So moved.
Got a motion to accept and a second. And Mike Rappish and then now chief. Chief that's willing to serve. Chad Sof. Okay. I'll second that. Made that. And a second for John Crowley. Those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none. Motion passes. Thank you.
You now want to go to the canine or?
Canine certifying entity discussion. So in your packet, you guys have Rule 728-508, which is Police Service Patrol and SWAT canine training certification and recertification standards. I don't recall exactly how many councils ago it was, but there was a suggestion and acceptance from the council in regards to updating Rule 728-508 as it pertains to certifying entities of patrol dogs and SWAT canine training. That added the term of qualifying canine certifying entity and it charged the post council with approving those entities and post director or post of maintaining that list. As of recent, we've had some inquiries from local kennels that are requesting or are interested in how this process works. I think there's a little bit of misunderstanding potentially with these kennels and the way the rule is written. My understanding and our legal understanding from our legal input is that these entities aren't necessarily issuing post certifications. They're issuing their own certification based off of these qualifications that are listed in rule. My question to you guys is, how do you want that presented? Do we invite them to council, let them give their presentation to you as a group, and you guys entertain the idea of adding them or not adding them to the list?
Personally, go ahead.
What are the outside of Post, what are the other certifying entities currently?
So I believe we have USPCA and...
The only one we have, there's two that in the state of Utah that haven't been approved by the Post Council that is used in Utah, is MPCA and CNCA are the two only active ones in Utah, but they have not been approved by the council yet.
So it had been long time practice that those individuals had been vetted by former canine program manager Wendell Knope, and they have not gone through the process since this rule was changed. So I guess technically.
So just for a quick comment, if you recall, this was Ken Wallentine was on the subcommittee along with Chief Carr from Harriman, and I think we grandfathered those two agencies in. So we grandfathered those two agencies as per recommendation per Chief Wallentine. So we do have those two agencies that have kind of been quasi-adopted by the Post Council, but if you guys want to consider those again, that's completely up to your purview, but that's the conversation I can recall with that subcommittee. So.
And I think some of these entities, I think, are hopeful that they can actually issue the post certification, which is not the intent of this rulemaking body. I feel that we lose the integrity of that certification by not having at least the testing ability. Right now, there is somewhat of, I guess I would call it a waiver process, just like an officer, right? If a canine goes through a training, whether it's out of state, whether it's through a kennel here within the state, that kennel or trainer provides training hours. They're instructed as to what is required of a post certification, and once those hours have been met and have been vetted by the canine program manager, that the hours are commensurate to what we train as post, that canine is allowed to challenge the canine certification test in Utah. So there's already a waiver process in place. This was set up to allow them to essentially have their own standalone certification that particular entity issued upon completion of said requirements in Rule 728.508.
So they could certify outside the post approval process, is what you're saying?
They wouldn't. They would be considered certified based off of being an approved. Looking for the verbiage here. Qualifying canine certifying entity. So they would be certified based off of your guys' approval of the kennel or the company, but they would not be post-certified. So for the agencies in the room, the issue that you run into with that is the simple fact that now post Art Lopez or Wendell Knope isn't necessarily going to be able to testify to their training, right? You can testify to what post trains and what we recognize as training, but this could potentially put post at odds with a post council approved company, if that makes sense.
Chief, and I'm not an expert in the canine field at all, we have a couple of canines, but I would want, just for liability reasons alone, a post certification versus an outside agency.
That's what I agree with that.
Basically, you're saying they would train the dog styles to come here to get certified, right?
That's the waiver process, right? With this rule, that's saying it's not necessary. So by a company being approved by post council and on the maintained list by the director or post, you are saying essentially that their certification would be recognized, not as a post certification, but you would recognize it as a valid certification. The rule is not that beneficial, I guess. That's what you're...
How did this rule come into because I don't really care for it. You know, because they can come before this body, and I'm telling you what, I don't know anything about canine other than they're pretty handy. I don't know that my contribution to this body saying that they should be able to do it on their own carries any weight. At least my vote on it doesn't, or, you know, whether they should be able to certify their own dogs, because I don't know anything about it. I don't know that I care for the rule either. It's, you know, people go to prison over what that dog said, you know, indicates on, and that's kind of a big deal. You take away people's freedom off of a dog's indication, and it needs to be right. And I don't know that we want to let go of any of that control. But if the rule allows it, are we bound to allow it?
Yes, so we are. So this was adopted pursuant to a change in 2021 SB 38, the canine policy amendments. So they enacted a new act, Law Enforcement Canine Team Certification Act. It's very, very short. There's only three parts to it, three sections to it. But essentially, it creates this qualifying canine certifying entity, and then it required the post to create this rule. And so that's when we created that subcommittee with Chief Carr, Chief Wallentine. We had somebody from DPS.
I think Sheriff Jensen might.
Jensen was on there as well. And then we had a DPS trooper that was, and I'm blanking out, it was either Banks or one of the troopers with the canine. And so this was the best option for us as far as the rule. So yeah. That just gives you a little bit of
that. And, you know, maybe I digress a little bit here. In the end, it's them that have to prove the validity of their dog in court. And so maybe it's not as much of a liability as I originally kind of thought, you know, because in the end, they still have their day in court, and that's the whole point of it, is for them to express and prove that that dog is good.
Does this mean we have two standards potentially?
Well, it's not two standards, because in Rule 728-508-4, it lists the requirements, right? So as long as they are training to that standard and passing a yearly, you know, the initial certification and a yearly recertification that is equivalent to what POST does to certify canines and handlers, then, like I said, like Sheriff said, that company would then be responsible to defend your officer and your agency in any sort of criminal action, civil action, anything like that.
Right, and if they're a private company, you know, and that crap happens, they can always, you know, go bankrupt or whatever.
So that's the issue, is that, one, we don't have the resources to oversee all of these companies that make come out of the woodwork, right, that want to do this. So it's basically on their honor system and you trusting them that they're covering what's required in rule.
So do we have the option of creating some sort of agreement, like blanket agreement with every company that wants to apply for this rule, wants to certify under this rule, that clarifies that they're assuming liability if their dog is not performing accurately? I mean, who knows if they will agree to that, but I wonder. I mean, I am not a police chief, obviously, or a head law enforcement official for an agency, but that would give me pause under those circumstances at trying to understand that hopefully they would assume liability, but they don't have to.
And I'm sure legally something could come up with.
We could come up with something.
But obviously, being very proud of our canine program here at POST and knowing the accolades that it has received, not only nationwide but around the world, I would say, you know, the training's free. You know, we train your handlers and your dogs for free, and it is the best training out there. So I'm sure there's some sort of legal agreement that we can come up with, that's some sort of binding contract for them. But at the end of the day, they're still going to have to testify for you or your agency or, and your handler if something were to go awry.
Familiar with the code that was established. Mr. Yockey, could you give us an idea of what is anticipated by that code? What does it actually establish? You said it was short. I don't want to take much time.
Extremely short. So essentially the code only has two definitions, and then it says law enforcement canine certifications, that each one should be certified and annually recertified, and then the next part says we create rules, and that is the entirety of the statute. So it is very brief as far as those three sections. The bill essentially just put everything on post and post council to essentially establish that. They just have to be certified and annually recertified, and that's...
We can't create a rule. Mr. Yockey, they have to be post-certified?
What are you looking at from post council so we got a clear definition of what you're we're trying to accomplish from this, because I'm a little unclear on it.
As far as... I was just explaining the statute. I think what Director, Deputy Director Garcia is looking at is just how you guys want us to present this information.
For example, I have a kennel that I've been on the phone with this past week that they're inquiring about the process and they want to come in front of post council. Is that how you guys want to handle that? And
a curriculum like a satellite academy?
As far as the curriculum goes, it would be out what is outlined in 728-508-4.
We're supposed to do any background work before they come before the council, so at least we have your buy-off on it.
We might be able to do something like that, but at the same time, it doesn't say post-approval, right? So if we get in the business of approving it and saying that it is valid, now we are essentially saying... without issuing the post-certification that they're post-certified. And I don't want to go down that path.
Go ahead. So kind of putting this in, so three options on here. One, leave the rule as it is, which means you can operate as a canine team in the state of Utah, either through post-certification or through this qualifying entity. Or add in there that to operate as a canine, a law enforcement canine in the state of Utah, you need to have post-certification, which means you've either been certified by post or you've challenged the course to be certified by post. Is that what we're scoping?
So with the rule that, with the way the rule is in place,
and I'm just going to pull this.
It says that it's an option, right? Currently. However, with the way we've been operating in the past, which has been beneficial, I think, to not only the law enforcement community, but the integrity of the certification, right, is that we have always had a challenge process in place. There's nothing saying that they can't go somewhere else and get trained as long as they provide training logs, the curriculum that they trained on, and then request to challenge the test through, at the time, retired Sergeant Wendell Nope and now Sergeant Art Lopez. So we allow dogs and handlers to challenge the test as long as they meet our standard. It's just like a waiver of an officer, right? The officer comes from California, they provide us their curriculum, we review the curriculum, make sure it's in line with what we teach, and we allow them to take the test. So with the dogs, it's no different. It was just that this rule was added, which now put a process in order and kind of muddied things.
So just in response to Colonel, what you were saying in regards to whether or not we would be able to put in our rule that we can have them go through the post-certification, this statute says essentially they can do one or the other. It has to be annually recertified by a qualifying canine entity or by a qualified. So I guess in theory we could adopt the rule and change it and say a qualifying canine entity is only post, but then I think you're going against the statute and you're putting yourself in a bind.
It seems like it makes more sense to table it right now, bring that committee back in. It was what, Ken Wallentine, Chief Carr, and who else?
I believe Sheriff Jensen, and I'm not them, sure who else.
You were on that as well. And have them explain to us where you guys landed, unless Chief Self can tell us where you landed on that. You know where you landed on this?
Well, we just decided those two had already been doing it, and so we, like Deputy Director said, we
integrated them into what we recommended, and then that was adopted here in post council. It came out of that committee, so that's where we were at.
So maybe the quick suggestion is this. Rather than saying, hey, post recognizes these guys or these other entities as doing post qualified, post certification, any of that, the idea is maybe we review their curriculum. They submit it and say, yeah, we recognize that they're teaching to the same standard, but post doesn't endorse or certify them. They want to be certified by post, they got to come through post. So basically we just say we've reviewed their training curriculum. It does meet the code as per this rule, but that's it. So
but then they still
if they want to be recognized as certified by post, they have to go through the post certification.
Or
all they're doing is saying we recognize yes.
Or the waiver.
They've or the waiver process.
Yeah. They've submitted that they teach to that standard, but we're not certifying them. We're not saying that they actually do. If they want to actually be post certified, they've got to go through the post.
And this has just come up recently with one or two kennels, local kennels. I don't know how often it'll come up or how many other entities may look into this process, but I don't assume it would be difficult for Art to Sergeant Lopez to review those curriculums, come to you guys and present and say, this is where it meets, this is where it doesn't, and make it a little easier for you guys to make an informed decision.
That'd be helpful.
That would be helpful. I think also perhaps someone could go out and look at their facility and see what they're doing, not just that they put it on paper, but actually what they're doing on, you know, where the rubber meets the road.
So that's where we run into problems with if this list grows. You know, the oversight makes it next to impossible, right? And like we can relate it back to the oversight of satellite academies as well. That's a daunting task for our basic training division, specifically the lieutenant, to keep track of 10 satellite academies and be able to make site visits, you know, every year, a couple times a year, to make sure things are going accordingly to, you know, how they're supposed to be doing things and delivering the curriculum. So this just adds one more complication where lieutenant has a full basic training staff, K-9 has one sergeant. And that oversight would be very, very difficult.
Maybe it's something you go to the legislature on, but if you get one lawsuit for a bad dog and it comes back on post, you will have paid for about five people to work for the lieutenant.
But I understand that, and that's why I don't want to get in the realm of saying that we endorse a specific vendor, right? Because now we do take on liability, and that's the road I don't want to go down.
Does this be a yearly type thing? Because I know, like with some kennels, they're in business one day, go hot and heavy, and then 6 months from now they're out of business. You get a dog from that kennel, they say certified, they're out of business. There goes any training, anything else that you could come back and say that guy didn't provide me somebody in court. Is this a yearly type thing?
And handler have to recertify every year? Not with this rule or the certifying entity.
Still, I mean, we have to report on the officers every year, right? If they're going to say their dog's certified, why don't we make them report every year as well? From the other
dog, doesn't dog report through a case or something, or have an account or something?
Not post-certified.
So it sounds like we have some leeway, right? I think the key word there is qualifying entity, right? And qualifying is established by administrative rule. So we can change and add to this rule. And Director Knorr's comment about making it similar to a satellite academy, and your comment, and we have an administrative rule that really specifies what a satellite academy must do in order to retain the status as a satellite academy. We could certainly develop something like that where they, and I understand that you don't want to have a lot of oversight, but we could put maybe some of that onus on the kennel to bring information or certification back to us that they're following the curriculum, following the things that they need to do.
How laborious is it to, after they've been through the training, the course with the certifying canine entity, to actually come and actually do the certification test here at Pulse?
To do the waiver? Is that what you're... Sergeant Lopez facilitates it all the time, and he's very flexible in being able to facilitate that. The problem is there aren't many entities out there that train to the level that we do at Post, and that's just simple as it is. There's three, how many hours in the
3 hours right now for a Post class for full patrol and potential of each.
But again, if they want to be a qualifying entity, we could require them to train to the level of Post, right? Isn't that what we're saying? Is that we expect that entity to be equal to what we require of a canine certified through Post. So through administrative rule, we ought to be able to require them to reach that level.
You can require them, but then, like I said, the oversight isn't necessarily there, right? Because they could say that, yes, we've trained this, and we've issued our certification, and that officer and canine may never come challenge the Post certification exam, right? So I guess the issue, and it's more for the chiefs and sheriffs to decide as to what
can we just simply
I don't think you can through rule.
So that's law.
We're kind of stuck because you know we have to get a statutory change.
I thought coming out of the committee that that's what we had decided on. It's been a couple of years, but that these canine kennels could train. They still had to come to Post for the certification. That you're saying that's not the case.
Not the way the rule is written.
Put that in the rule, like Sheriff Sparks was saying, maybe add to it so that has to take place. I mean, they can still do the training and the hours, but if they come to Post and they can't pass, then they have to come to Post to learn how to do it correctly and pass.
We can evaluate the rule if that's what this body wants, and like the chair suggested, bring the subcommittee back and revisit this and try to fine tune it.
You do have a number of instructors and canine judges that are adjuncts to the Post staff, right?
Correct.
So it would be possible, perhaps, to have one of them attend a certification test that's conducted by one of these other entities.
That would be possible, but then...
Even if it's just as an observer to make sure that they're...
I think that would also have to be specified in the rule that they would have to notify us when they're testing a canine or a handler, and we would have to make arrangements to make that happen.
Can we reestablish the committee to review the rule, what the content of the discussions happened here? Here's the concern I have is every law enforcement agency out there, whatever canine is available is the one that responds. It may be with your agency, maybe with another one, and we are all relying on each other's canine teams and certification, and ultimately to be able to support whatever criminal case we're involved with that case. I think it's at least worth making sure we've got a good universal standard of certification.
We got a motion from Colonel Rappage and a second from Chief Swanson. Any further discussion?
A suggestion that we ask Ken Valentine perhaps to come back as part of that committee, even though he's not part of Post. Would you accept that?
Absolutely.
As an amendment?
Okay. We have an amendment. Yes. Spence Austin.
First member would be Ken Wallentine.
And then we can form that subcommittee based on either past representatives or maybe look to him to help us come up with a group that would be the most qualified to review that process.
And Ms. Gomez can pull up that list later this afternoon once we leave this meeting and pull up who the members were and we can get that going.
That'd be great. I would recommend
at least a good mix of current people on this body that have knowledge of what's supposed to happen so they can help assist when the person presents to Post.
Chief Self, you were on that committee previously.
Yeah.
Would you be willing to serve on that again?
Sure.
Do we have anyone else that would be willing to serve on that? Colonel, you're going to be on that?
I could. It's not, I'm not a canine. I've never been a canine handler. I've employed a lot of them. But yeah, we can assist with that as well.
So we can start with three and then work out
from that. That would work. Mr. Sweeney, are you shaking your head like you want to participate on this committee?
Oh, I was just agreeing to three.
Oh, okay. All right. Sorry, I just thought you were saying, yeah, I'd love to serve on that committee.
I don't know expertise, but if you need one more body.
Is that still a motion?
Do we have a motion? Do we need to solidify that motion?
So
it's your so like, would have been a final motion.
Yeah.
You want to go ahead and make that again?
Trying to figure out exactly what we did. So, to reconstitute the committee regarding canine, come back with a recommendation, and I think understand a whole lot better what we're talking about here, because I think there's a lot of vagueness in everything that we've heard, and have Ken Wallentine as part of that committee. Well, with
I'd suggest you have the Colonel and Chief Sogel,
so,
and then they can consult with whoever they need.
Okay.
So it doesn't limit them, okay. And they can go out to dog handlers that they have in their agencies, outside agencies or whatever, and then at least a gentleman can be in charge of,
you know, chief and report back.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Chief Wallenheim has been a dog officer as well as being chief of law enforcement for about 40 years. In addition to being a lawyer.
But we'll leave that out.
That's the dog officer.
That's the motion.
That's the motion. Okay, do we have a second?
Second.
This is my second. Travis Warner, go ahead. Any further discussion?
Hearing none, I'll call for
the vote. Those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion passes.
All right, I'll carry on with my next item. Annual training requirements. We've been dealing with this now since July of 2021 with the inclusion of the mandated 16 hours to be included in the 40 hours of required training to maintain certification. As you all are aware, this last year another hour was added to that under House Bill 297, which has to do with the sexual assault, sexual abuse, and sexual trauma investigations. That goes into effect July 1, 2023. So for this coming fiscal year, that will require 17 required hours out of the 40. The packet that's attached lists the statute 536202, annual training requirements, and then has some following documents. In this document, there's been some changes that are being suggested. The additions will be in red, highlighted in red, and any sort of deletions or anything like that will be struck from the overall description for approval. As we're talking about House Bill 162, which was from 2021 and required these hours, if you all could go back to about that time, that was a rough time for law enforcement. And I think the premise behind these 16 hours was very specific. And that had to do with arrest control, de-escalation, mental illness, crisis intervention. And that pertained directly to the responding officer and the actions on scene of a responding officer, not further investigation or a detective's work or involvement in that investigation. It was on scene, critical incident. How do we de-escalate? How do we teach our officers to use arrest control tactics using the least amount of force possible? How do we reinforce these de-escalation techniques? And how do we recognize some of these disabilities or critical incidents or crises, right? Somewhere along the way, there's been many of interpretations of what was meant by that law and what qualifies as training for those hours. To the degree of, I understand chiefs and sheriffs and chief administrators are the ones that are approving this curriculum or these training hours. However, ultimately it falls onto the director to make sure that it fits the standard or it post to make sure it fits what the intent of the legislation was. So for example, with the arrest control, over the last 2 years, we've seen a lot of training submitted under that arrest control category for less lethal certifications or less lethal recertifications, right? Is that a form of control? Yes, but we're going back to what was going on at the time when this legislation was rolled out. It was the fact that the public was in an uproar about use of force, excessive use of force. Therefore, that's why the training was put in place, right? To effectively teach our officers how to use arrest control tactics to use less force. Being able to use a taser, yes, that is could be a form of de-escalation in a sense or arrest control in a sense, right? But I don't believe, and Post does not believe, that the intent was for pepper spray recertification or EDC or ECD recertification, right? This was for hands-on, how do we get somebody detained properly without causing further injury or death and make the situation safe, right? So that has been specified in the arrest control. De-escalation has stayed the same. If you look at the mental health or mental illness crisis intervention, some words were added to be more clear on that, right? We're talking about an immediate mental crisis, right? The response to an immediate mental crisis. Key elements including understanding neurobiology of trauma and recognizing a traumatic reaction to a crisis and the appropriate response to assist the individual in the midst of that crisis, not 2, 3, 4 days later as a follow-up. Right. This is in the moment. How do we keep people safe? How do we keep our officers safe? Completion of the autism course also fulfills this requirement, has been struck. Right. If you look at the verbiage from House Bill 334, which is on the following page, which required the autism training, it doesn't specify autism only. That verbiage of that law states that it also covers autism spectrum disorder and other neurological and developmental disorders, right? So that broadens that category for you as agencies and does not pigeonhole you with offering autism every single year over and over to where it becomes white noise for your officers. We want them staying engaged. We want them to take the training serious, right? And when you get the same thing over and over every year, it's human nature. I know we all have done it. We kind of watch the PowerPoint in the background, right? And that's what we want to avoid. So the autism training has been struck as far as being titled autism training, and it's being listed as special needs training. And I'll go ahead and read this aloud. An approved course focuses on developing an understanding of individuals with special needs, as well as the distinctive requirements involved in providing service for mental disabilities, autism spectrum disorder, and other neurological and developmental disorders. The training requirement provides an understanding of the specific needs of an individual. Instruction will include skill to effectively support and intervene in these diverse conditions. The training will cover various topics, including the characteristics, behaviors, and challenges associated with these disabilities. And then finally, on the last page is House Bill 297, which I mentioned before, which adds the additional hour to the 16, bringing it to 17. That includes sexual assault abuse training, and that was legislatively mandated and must be incorporated in, and there's the description for that as well. So what I'm asking from you guys today is an approval on these with the understanding that we are doing everything we can to make this process as easy as possible. I do ask for your guys' forgiveness and a little bit of grace in the fact that I know your agencies are dealing with it on an agency level, and we are dealing with every officer in the state, right, which is nearly 9,000, fluctuates a little below, a little above 9,000 every year. And ultimately, yes, you guys are responsible for the record-keeping lesson plans and all of that, but Post is adding their stamp of approval, right, on every single one of these submissions that comes through. And if we want to maintain the integrity of this certification, departments and Post, we need to scrutinize this training and make sure that it is meeting the intent of what the legislation was and the requirements, and stay ahead of the game. Instead of being reactionary to legislation that comes out, let's make sure we're upholding our end of the deal. So my suggestion or my proposal to you as council would be to adopt these for the training year of 2023-24 for the 17 required hours.
Just one question. You mentioned 17 required hours, but as I look at this chart, it actually makes it look as though there were 18 required hours. The hour of special needs, and I really appreciate what you've done, the new definition there, I think it's great. But that hour is actually part of the 16, is that correct? still be intent?
If council approves that, it would be good to bump it up to 18, but we just wanted to make you aware that
I'm not suggesting bumping it up to 18. I would suggest that special needs training, we made part of that 16 hours, understanding that at least one of those 16 hours must include that special needs training. So I would prefer to stay at the 16
versus increasing it by an hour.
Yeah.
We'll already have to go to 17 because of House Bill 297 from this last year. But yes, that special needs would count towards the 16. That would maybe just decrease maybe your de-escalation training by an hour, right? Or your defensive tactics by an hour. But it would be encompassed in that 16, correct?
So, Sheriff, you're suggesting that you stay with 17 total new hours.
Yeah. I hope so. Otherwise, I need another hour really quickly.
Well, this will not go into effect until this will not affect the reporting period ending at the end of this month. This will just affect July 1, 2023 to June 30th, 2024.
I'm getting too prescriptive on the CIT.
So if I can further expand on that and maybe clarify some things, the CIT program is 40 hours, right? That entire 40 hours does not discuss de-escalation, right? It goes into a bunch of different avenues of crisis intervention, to where we have had agencies try to submit the full 40 hours as de-escalation training, right? Which you're going to have to break down the hours as to, okay, yes, there was 3 hours that were appropriated to de-escalation. I know it's a lot of work, but there's no way we can rightfully say you got 40 hours of de-escalation training because you went through CIT. So that's why the definition is a little bit less broad, to one, make sure we're getting proper hours, and two, reducing the frustrations of agencies submitting things and getting them rejected and having to redo them. And this is a learning process for all of us. We're trying to streamline it as much as possible to be beneficial for the departments. Trust me, we do not want to make this harder. I think Cody, which is downstairs in our cave that approves everything that comes in, Cody might not want to work here anymore. So I'm trying to keep Cody a little bit happy and make his life easier as well.
I mean, my thought as I read that was the intention not for the 40 hours and those that are being newly certified in CIT, but the recertification, which is far fewer hours, would be when that would be particularly relevant, because if they went to a portion of the CIT training that was not, to your point, directly related to de-escalation, they could go in, you know, to a much different section that's focusing more on.
Well, and that's where the and that's kind of the confusion we had with these overlap, right? And there's no way to necessarily separate them out individually. So, yes, there's mental health training that might be able to count for, depending on what the agency chooses, de-escalation or mental health crisis intervention, right? These is just giving the parameters of what would account for what. John, did you have something else?
I can mention on the mental illness, these descriptions are coming after seeing now 2 years of thousands and thousands of submissions by agencies and feedback from the agencies on, it would be great if you could clarify this more, or could you help us more? So this is really, these red lines are based on agency feedback on wanting more direction from the council. On the mental illness with the CIT program, we just simply put in, before it was a blanket, CIT program flat out counts no matter what. And agencies were like, well, you know, does that really count, or does all of it count, or how does that work? So we're just simply broadening to say that the part of the CIT program that covers that immediate response, which was the original intent, that can count. And then the reason why I put in the neurobiology and trauma, this comes from Utah Prosecution Counsel, Director Church, and the training they do statewide. They're the ones that are on the front lines of training a lot of the agencies on this, and they're saying you really need to add to that mental health description that the officer needs to understand the neurobiology of trauma. they can't recognize a crisis response unless they understand what is happening to the individual that has caused that crisis response. So the mental illness, we did broaden it up to including neurobiology and trauma based on the prosecution counsel's feedback from training agencies statewide that this would be a helpful addition to further guide agencies into a higher quality training.
To maybe smooth things over a little bit too for you guys as far as adding that extra hour, House Bill 297 says a minimum of an hour. I believe UPC is in the process of putting together an in-person class that will meet this requirement. I'm sure it will be longer than an hour. But to assist the agencies, POST is actually going to create an online version of this course, an e-learning course, to meet this requirement under House Bill 297. It hasn't been done yet. I'm not sure if it'll end up being in an hour or 2 hours. But it should be available not at the beginning of this fiscal year, obviously, starting July 1, but at some point during that year for your officers to just log into ACADIS and take that training.
The House Bill 297 is unique because in our code, 536-202-6, it actually refers 536-10-9081 to the specific elements that have to be included in that training. If you look at the specific elements that have to be included in that training, you'd be very hard-pressed to cover that in 1 hour. Even though the law says a minimum 1 hour, if you look at the requirements in 5610908 that have been there for a couple years now, it's pretty extensive. And so our online training would be minimum 2 to 3 hours just to meet that description. So the sexual assault abuse, that description is defined in law, whereas the other ones are left up to the director and advice and consent of post counsel.
Sorry,
I'm not overjoyed at the thought that the 1 hour training is actually going to end up being 2 or 3 hours, because now you're taking a course my guys have to take, but you're actually taking up more hours than what's necessary, because I'm not going to get credit for my less lethal, which I don't necessarily agree with, because I think this was in light of the George Floyd death, and that was just a use of excessive deadly force that day. And I think we're looking for anything, whether it's de-escalation expertise or a better understanding of mental health, I think we would have appreciated less lethal being used that day, because lethal force was what was used that day. And so I don't necessarily agree that less lethal shouldn't contribute at least something to our hours we're trying to accomplish. And, you know, and in addition to all these 16 hours, we still have to get our guys through deadly force. We got to get our guys through less lethal force. We have to get our guys, even the nuance of defensive tactics versus arrest control. It's DT we're teaching, but it's arrest control we're requiring. And are they synonyms? Are they the exact same? And so I don't know. There's some of this I think is good, but some of it that I think we're not capturing enough of what could have prevented the tragedy of George Floyd. And I think less lethal does contribute, is a tool that could have been used that day to prevent the death of George Floyd. And so
it's up to interpretation of what the statute is saying, but also it's clarified that it's the director's interpretation.
Right.
That's where.
So yeah.
I guess my hard. I have a couple of issues with it. I went to a mental health training, went through a whole ton of extra stuff. I got denied on my training because we spent hours and hours going through what goes through the human brain, what they're doing in crisis. But because I didn't list how to respond to it, I got denied. So I'm okay if we add some hours or whatever we got to do, but at the same time, I disagree with cutting apart programs and saying, okay, only this many hours of it matches, only this many hours is okay. It may make it easier on post, which I'm great because I think I agree. I think Cody, he gets beat up by me pretty regular as well. But it makes it harder on the agencies to sit down and say, okay, now I got to nitpick through every hour of this training course to see what meets and what doesn't. And that's going to be harder on us, on the end user. And eventually we'll get to that point where we just say, fine, I'll watch the PowerPoint in the background. And it's ineffective. I think we need to make sure that we either find a program that covers all the bases and we make sure we do it so we're not splitting it up, because that makes it harder on us, because then we'll just say, fine, I'm not going to CIT. If CIT doesn't cover and count the whole thing, I'm not going.
Well, you got two different parts
of CIT, if I'm not mistaken. You have the 40-hour certification, and then you have just the CIT awareness that we need for the law, correct? Is that correct? And I think that's where it becomes very confusing, just as you said. You know, we're trying to pull videos that are relevant to that, that are in a specific category, and I feel that it's become way too prescriptive, and it's become way too difficult to decipher what counts and what doesn't count. And they've taken a lot of the ability from chiefs and sheriffs and administrators to look at that and say, you know, at the end of the day, I'm going to be responsible for my officer's training. I think that's become a real problem.
And I would agree with that, but the way the statute's written, it puts the onus on the post and the post director to validate those hours.
I understand.
And
that.
So this isn't a personal want by post. This has made life difficult on everybody.
But I'm wondering if we could create specific programs that are tailored to those hours. So we could say, you watch this, you get this credit hour, so that we're not going, you know, an extra 2 or 3 hours when we really only need an hour of it. Because we're getting to a point we can't even facilitate the hours on top of all the other expectations we're given.
I like that idea. I like the idea of us having, okay, this is what you do to accomplish these hours. But then we end up doing the exact same thing year after year. We're not broadening the horizon of our officers. We're not creating growth. It's a go through the motions program.
Right.
And that's why I think we need to be a little more inclusive of what gets approved as mental health training. Because it might be autism this year, it might be Down syndrome next year, it might be hard of hearing the following year. I just think there's I think we need to broaden it, because we deal with people from all walks of life that experience all kinds of mental illness or disabilities that become a challenge when we are trying to impose law upon them. And de-escalation. I may put my people through a verbal judo class. I don't know if that's going to qualify for de-escalation, but verbal judo is a form of de-escalation. And so I just think that if we want to create growth, we need to offer different training rather than say, watch this post video and you qualify. Because once I've watched the video once, how many times do I have to see it? This thing with firearms and less lethal, we can hit a different less lethal harder annually, or we can implement a new less lethal program, and same with firearms. We can do this course of fire this session and then this course of fire next session, but if we do a prescriptive one, I'm not really developing my people. They're not growing. They are doing what they have to do to accomplish this. And maybe that's what we have to do to satisfy the statutory requirement. But in the end, I feel like legislature messed up on this one then, if that's what they want. If they want us to go through the motions of popping in 16 hours worth of online training, or 17 hours or 18 hours, whatever it ends up being by the end of today, I don't think that's truly developing our staff. And so, like I said, I think we do have to meet the requirements, but I think we need to be a little more inclusive on what gets accepted into our, what gets approved.
If I could speak on that, House Bill 297 this year, the original language was every officer in the state has to watch online. We worked with prosecution counsel as part of this. and we argue for agencies to say, no, what might be needed at Department of Corrections is entirely different what's needed on the road. Therefore, leave that open to the agencies. And so that's why 297 is saying a minimum 1 hour, follow some prescriptions, but it's up to the agency. On mental health, we're trying to add that trauma, that neurobiology of trauma, to kind of help your situation where you learned about the neurobiology of trauma, but our description didn't have it in there. You just talked about immediate crisis. And so so we're trying to open up mental health, or the crisis intervention, we're trying to open that up. Same thing with special needs. For the past 2 years, we've mandated through this description that it's autism, 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 and we're trying to open it up and say, let's just not talk about autism. Let's talk about all the other special needs and let your department decide, do you need autism this year? Do you need Downs, or do you need Fragile X, or what do you need as a department? So the whole goal of this is to broaden the description to give agencies greater leeway to decide what they want, whether it's special needs, mental health. We're trying to go big. We're not trying to come down.
And I think on that particular portion of this, I applaud you. I think that is well done, and opening up broader to more special needs. I think it's some of the other that I think is causing me a little more angst than that in particular.
Specifically the arrest control?
Yeah. I think any kind of use of force, whether it's soft hand, hard hand, less lethal, the deadly force, really should contribute to these hours of arrest control. And, you know, maybe deadly force is not the most appropriate one, but I think everything up to that really should be part of an arrest control tactic. Because we'd start in the beginning with our verbal contact. Typically, we're going to try to verbally de-escalate somebody. And so I think we run the whole spectrum right up to, because the whole point here is to avoid killing people. And that's the whole point of this training, that, you know, are suffering, whether it's mental illness or, you know, I think another one, we got denied, we did a harm reduction training. And that was basically harm reduction for addicts, people that are struggling with addiction. And, you know, how we can deal with a drug addict, because it's not mental health, but he's strung out on drugs, it sure seems mental health, and we got denied that. And so I think a harm reduction component could be included as part of the mental health as well, because that's our goal in all of this, is to reduce harm, regardless of what area of society or need or disadvantage the people we're dealing with are coming from. And so the whole point is to reduce the harm we have upon them and hopefully end things peacefully.
Deputy Director, can you remind us if in HB 162, substance use disorder was specifically excluded from the mental illness and crisis intervention requirements? Because if it wasn't specifically excluded, I think it would be prudent for us to include that within mental and behavioral health circles. Substance use and mental illness is often linked, because often users are using, they're self-medicating and then become addicted. I mean, it can be at times challenging to tease those two apart. I know that there's specific legislation in other areas that separates those two as far as funding. If in this case they're not, it could be prudent upon us to include that.
Specifically with House Bill 162, it said topics of de-escalation, arrest control, and crisis intervention, mental health. So nothing specifically excluded, no.
Could we call that out to this previous point, that mental illness, crisis intervention, substance use disorder? Because I think that could be valuable to law enforcement to that point, to be able to understand when someone is strung out on something and acting, you know, in a way that could be a mental illness, could be substance use disorder. I mean, they are very complementary, yeah.
Sure.
I do not want to create another committee. So my idea is to have the curriculum committee, because this has to do with curriculum and what is being taught,
quickly meet and review these and come up with verbiage that you all are satisfied with, and we can implement that.
I like what has been done. I like the diagram, right, with the hours that are there specifically as a template, as a platform for you all who are in charge of your agencies. Marcus, what is your thought about adding underneath arrest control, de-escalation, mental illness, crisis intervention, special needs training, not the verbiage of something to the effect of not limited to, but could include supervisor differentiation and adaptation to current personnel? That would give you all that are in charge of your agency a little bit of flexibility to say, hey, this officer probably needs a little bit more training, because you were mentioning that you were giving out yoga, whatever, or I don't know. But anyway, there you go, judo. Those kinds of but I'm saying, could something like that verbiage be added to these components? I don't think agencies disagree with what has been said, but given you guys, I mean, I know in my world, I hated specifics in my world, but I like the ability to differentiate based on individualized training that I could give, because no one officer or teacher are the same, correct? And if they're not the same, then I think those of you that are in charge of your agency should be able to differentiate how you feel your personnel needs that individualized training. I don't know. That's just me.
So there is that option to add something like that in there. I think the concern is because we are obligated to return back to the look, the legislature keeps hitting us up, and that's the concern is, oh, we're going to have to report back to them. And it does, the statute does say the director shall ensure that training covers X, X, and X. And so the onus would be put on the director of post, and whether or not that's actually being satisfied. And so I think if we do leave it up a broad discretion like that, I think it does create a little bit of an issue. And I think that's why last year we initially provided those descriptive things, is just so we could say, hey, this is what the legislature wanted. Again, we are going to have to return back to the legislature and say, yes, this is how law enforcement is satisfying this, or this is how they're not satisfying it. So, but again, it does say subject to the approval of the majority vote of the post council. So.
But that's the added part.
Liability-wise, I'm glad to place it back on you guys. So
the added part under House Bill 162, it says, the annual training shall include no less than 16 hours of training focused on mental health and other crisis intervention responses, arrest control, and de-escalation training. Part 2, standards for the training shall be determined by each law enforcement agency or department and approved by the director designated. Doesn't say the director has to go through every little bit of part of it, just says he has to approve it. Now you can determine, you know, how does he decide that? But if the director, the agency, it says department or approved by director, which director? I'm assuming post, but it also says the agency head may do that, and each law enforcement agency or department shall include a breakdown. So we got to do a breakdown of what the 16 hours were trained on, but it doesn't say we have to be this specific. I know that's what the law says, and there may be other intent, but I want to make sure that we understand that that's the law says. There's still that ability for an agency to approve that, say, this meets our needs, which I think is what Miley's saying, that agency needs to happen. But I also feel like if we start getting so specific, we get clear.
And just to clarify, Sheriff Curtis, so that's on 4C. You do still have five 5-6, and so subsection 5-6 and 7 that says that shall ensure. Yeah. So there are those extra ones. So, yeah.
Director Stevenson was part of the crafting of the original 136, and there was two thoughts. One, the agencies all submit their curriculum to post to the director or designee and have that approved in advance, which would overwhelm our staff to the point where we couldn't do anything other than approve 236 agencies time how many lesson plans. The other thought the director Stevenson had, this is the course we kind of went, was if the director and post council gives general guidance of what would be an approved course, then that would give guidance to the agency so they could go out and do conduct the training and then come back and not be as surprised. I realize that there's some surprises. It's a very difficult system we're working through. But those were the two thoughts, that we could either approve in advance or we could give direction to say if your course meets this broad description, it'll be approved by the director or designee, which is Cody Sparks.
Based off of the description.
Based off of the descriptions. So that this template is actually what gives Cody Sparks the ability to delineate, would the director approve it? And the reason why we're coming to post council is because this has been a very tumultuous 2 years for every agency and post, and it has taken staff time that we just don't have staff time for. So as much as we could smooth out this process for everybody, realizing the impact it's had on the agencies, which was a surprise. As much as we could do to help that, we could try to talk.
Yeah, I don't want to drag this out any further than it has to be, but is there room for these negotiations, and has there been room for you to deny something and me call you and explain exactly how that training went and then you approve it?
There,
has that happened?
There's been dialogue,
not necessarily a phone call, meet to me personally, but I know Lieutenant has handled, and then also emails back and forth amongst staff and the involved agency or officers. That
has been reversed?
Yes, it has, with a modification to the description, right? Because I'm signing off that description that you submitted meets the standard that...
There's nothing we need to do. If those conversations are already taking place and there's room for, okay, we'll approve that, and then what are we doing?
It doesn't happen every time, I think.
With clarification on what the training actually entailed, yes, we have had some reversals. Like, okay, no, that does meet the description. But unfortunately, I'd say more often than not, and I can't speak for everybody here, but when I've had those conversations, I'd say more often than not, I say, no, based on the definitions we have, that still doesn't. So, again, I think there is still some work to be done by both Post and the Council on that.
Is this something we intend to review every year, at least for the next couple of years, as
intent as we work through the growing pains, because obviously the descriptions that were put together for the first year didn't suffice and caused a bunch of problems. So we're trying to make this easier, guys. The original discussions under House Bill 162 were to make all 40 hours post-approved. We don't want that. We want you guys to have your freedom to choose what you're training your officers are. You're dealing with them every day. You know what their needs are and what they don't need. And this was the best we could do legislatively, was to chop it down to 16 required hours.
How far off we are from these descriptions, Sheriff Limmer, I know you have an exception for the less lethal courses, but I think we could, as a council, delete that if we wanted to delete it. But are we close enough? I think what we're trying to get, and part of this is training coordinators, right, to make sure that the descriptions that they use come from this verbiage, right? If they just use this verbiage when they report training, we wouldn't have a problem, right? This would be fine. So I'm not sure if we're far off on these, with maybe a couple of changes that we could make right now today, we could probably approve and adopt.
I think we're there with what you just said, and I do. I think part of this is training our people, our training coordinators, to make sure that the right verbiage is included in the description, because often it's in the training they attended. They just don't always capture that verbiage correctly. correctly to where it, so I think we're really honestly there.
Well, you just give up this, right? Or something like this and say, use this language. Use this language, you're good.
These are included as part of the instructions when they get onto a CADIS to enter the information. So.
You do have it. Cody is a year-round, full-time asset that is working. And agencies, actually, this is our third year now. So we've actually, this is our second year of reporting that's ending this week. He's working with agencies full-time year-round because you do have turnover in your training department. And so we do always have a dedicated point of contact for agencies to be explained, walked through, helped. So I've been tracking the changes, drop less lethal, drop that red line, add harm reduction and substance use disorders for mental illness. Those were kind of the three modifications to what this was.
Drop my vote in that.
There's a thought on there, in terms of the discussion, can be written to be more inclusive language instead of exclusive language. It kind of reads a little bit like it's going to be this and this alone, instead of saying that it could be, it should be included or include these. I don't know. I usually can speak better than this, but it sounds a little bit. When you read it, it sounds like, okay, you're either doing this or it doesn't.
So what if the verbiage of
it does say it's not limited to, but this is the way it gets applied though, is if it's not that, it is limited to it. That's practice versus what is said is different. So
subjects would include or should include or
but are not limited to.
It says that, but it's applied. That's okay.
And then I think Sheriff Sparks actually hit it right on the head, is agencies just to make sure they're actually using the right descriptors when they're reporting their training, mm-hmm. instead of, because Sheriff Wim was right, less lethal training, if it's done correctly, includes this de-escalation. It's not just the mechanics of deploying a taser. It's everything that leads up to the deployment of a taser, which includes a lot of de-escalation, but that needs to be articulated that way, not just taser certification.
How about we make a motion with the approved changes up to the 17 hours?
With the requirement that we review this again before the beginning of next fiscal year.
Well, not that too. Is that motion enough for me to second?
Yes, we can go ahead and make. We got a motion. What is the second? Second.
So just
for the discussion.
Just to make sure I'm clear, approving what we have written here with the addition of the changes that John mentioned.
Yes.
Okay. And the requirement that we review it next year.
The requirement we do it every year. So it include the red line on arrest control. And then include the
harm reduction.
The harm reduction.
And
substance abuse.
Substance abuse.
Well. It's only 17, not 18 hours.
Yes.
And it's every year post council in the June session where we need to revise based on the curriculum committee's recommendations.
Yes, that's my motion.
Collective motion.
I'll second that one as well.
Okay, so that's the motion. Those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
All right. Do you have another topic?
I got one more. Man, I do wish we had a director. So this discussion has to do with the addition of 536211 sub I, and this was something that was brought up last time as far as in last council meeting determining whether or not or what the sanction would be or a violation of I. So if you go down to I, 536211, it reads, is a chief sheriff or administrative officer of a law enforcement agency and fails to comply with subsection 6. Subsection 6 has to do with findings of an internal investigation where there's a violation of 536211 and the requirement for chief sheriff or administrator to report that to post. So because I was added during this last legislative session, there needs to be a post sanction attached to that violation. And this body gets to determine where that falls.
Category A, B, C, D, E, et cetera? Or, is that what you're asking for?
Or are you asking for a general range, like this falls one level higher because they're higher in command?
Yeah. That is a discussion to be had amongst you.
One thing is, especially for sheriffs, is that when we get elected, we're required to have a letter from post saying we're in good standing to take office. So that's where that's a direct impact on sheriffs. If we're not complying with that, post issues a letter that just basically says we're not in compliance. Well, we're not in good standing with folks.
For a letter of caution, is that what you're saying?
Well, just as when we file to take office, right. we have a letter from post saying we're in good standing with post. And that's one area where we could be, if we're not doing that, post says no, they're not in good standing.
That would only be required once every 4 years, right?
Honestly, though, what happens? You're elected, so.
I don't know what happens.
I've heard all sorts of suggestions as to what should take place. One of the suggestions was that one offense lower than what the officer was in violation of, one offense higher because the administrator should have known they should have turned it over. I don't know what the answer is. I'm glad I'm not a part of you guys deciding this.
Currently, there's no sanction.
Correct. So just for sake of discussion, if you go category F, the range is letter of caution to a one-year suspension, which ranges the ability from no impact on the certification to actually enough of an impact on the certification to have to come back through and be certified or return to law enforcement. I guess if that's just a baseline to start with, that gives the council the ability to look at each one of the individual circumstances. Uh-huh. What are the mitigating and aggravating factors? What is the level of offense and all of them?
I agree with Colonel Rappage. I think what we should be considering is what is the message that we want to send to chiefs and sheriffs, right? Because we always have the ability to go anywhere from a letter of caution to a revocation, right? Uh-huh. Most council legally has that ability. This is a guide, so to me, I think it's what is the message that we want to send to chiefs and sheriffs about the importance of reporting the post.
And a question on this on subsection C. So it states a chief sheriff or administrative officer. Would that be inclusive of command staffs of police or sheriff's office as well? Or is that just indicative of DPS and corrections? Okay, so this is just
the number one chief law enforcement official.
And then also to clarify that this states that the agency, any of those people who are made aware of the allegations. So for instance, if there was someone in an administrative position that directly oversaw someone that provided a violation and did not disclose to the chief or sheriff or director, they would not be liable according to the subsection.
If they were certified potentially for something else, like official misconduct.
But not for this.
So this would just be for chief law enforcement officials that willfully refused to provide information to post regarding one of their employees.
Refused to do an investigation, refused to submit a post. So we do have an admin rule that backs this up. I encourage you to look that over. But it provides, so 6 and 7 kind of go together, subsection 6 and 7, oh, sorry, 6, A, and B, so just make sure you're looking at that. We will be sending out a letter just to the chiefs and sheriffs, just letting them know about this fun new term of events.
I could bring recall your attention back to when 536211 G and H were added. The standpoint was
taken to look at it as a category, where am I at? Category that Colonel Rappich mentioned, which was anywhere from that 3 month to a year. And that was looked at based on, okay, let's give it an evaluation period, right? To see one, how many cases we get and determine how egregious, how, you know, and kind of generate your own baseline based off of cases as they present themselves. Category E, sorry.
Category F was the one you were talking about, the one where you guys
about. Colonel Rask was talking about category F.
Yeah. Okay. The only difference between is death. Well, the other one goes to a half year suspension, the other one, the baselines are the difference. I think category F gives teeth that we're looking for.
I would make an argument for
category E, just because of the language in category E that acknowledges that an officer can be disciplined for dishonesty or deception. And I think this really goes along the lines of dishonesty or deception by failing to report, failing to follow their obligation to report to post. So this is a conversation.
It's the first time that a chief or sheriff that's getting notice of this is going to begin over-reporting everything. I would anticipate that any sort of consequence for not reporting that could be a liability of a chief or sheriff or other law enforcement official would be a pretty good incentive.
And category E still gives us the lower end of letter of caution within the range and just goes up another 6 months. So.
And the over-reporting would
definitely be better than under-reporting. It's a whole lot easier to say as a chief or sheriff, hey, I gave it to post and Post didn't do anything, right? Now the onus is on us and our investigative staff. So we get calls. Lieutenant Moore gets calls weekly inquiring about cases and giving information, and she can, for the most part, give a yes or no over the phone based off of the details that are provided, right? And that's your due diligence.
Apply category E to it.
Category E, and a second from Lena Stevens. Any further discussion? Hearing none, I'll call for a vote. Those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
The opposed? Hearing none, the motion passes.
All right, thank you. I'm not a member of council, but can maybe a 5-10 minute break?
Let's go ahead and I got a motion to go into to take a break. We have one from Colonel Rappich, second. All right. We'll see you back here at 10 minutes till.